Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Okay, everybody, if you're looking for a way to pass the time this winter, I've got just a solution for you. Go to www.bcinteriorsci.ca and join a great conservation organization and help them advocate for hunters from all over. While we're on the topic of conservation, have you all heard of 2% for Conservation? 2% is a nonprofit organization that helps promote people and businesses that have dedicated at least 1% of their time and 1% of their money to conservation. I can't say enough about them over there. You can check them out at www.fishandwildlife.org. Okay, so this is episode number 15 of the Focus Hunting Podcast. On this episode, I'm joined by James Gibran. Him and his brother Lucas have found a really cool way to engage youngsters in topics of conservation. Smile Outside introduces kids to the importance and different aspects of nature through a series of books. After this podcast, make sure you go and check out their webpage. They can be found at www.smileoutside.com. Make sure to use the promo code FOCUS1. That's the number one, not the word one, and you're going to receive 10% off your order. James is going to tell you more about Smile Outside, so let's get into it here.
Well, this sucks.
Yeah, I can hear you good, buddy. Weather looks good down there.
Oh man, it's cold today. I think it's like 40 something degrees.
Oh, that's rough. That's rough. You're down in Florida.
No, I'm in Houston, Texas.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I have a Florida number. I used to be in Florida.
Oh, I see. Gotcha. Yeah. Right on. Well, thanks for taking a bit of time to come on the show with me, man.
My pleasure, man. Appreciate the invite.
That's great. So you're ready to roll. We'll just maybe dive into this.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
There's a couple of hunts of yours that I'm just dying to get into, one especially, but before we dive into that, can you give the listeners an introduction to yourself, maybe, you know, where you grew up and your connection to the outdoors, that sort of thing?
So my name's James Gibran, and I've been hunting my entire life. My dad took my brother and my sisters fishing since we were tiny, my brother and I hunting since we were tiny. It's a really important thing to my brother and I. Being in the outdoors, wildlife, and being able to enjoy places that are still pristine. And unfortunately, those places are dwindling. My brother and I, we co-founded the company, Smile Outside, which I think we're going to get to here in just a little bit. Basically, though, it's a company that we try to introduce kids to wildlife and wild places and give back to conservation.
Yeah, right on, man. So, you and your brother started the company.
Yes, sir.
How's it been working with your brother? I know I have two brothers. I have a business here. We started out in business together. It didn't work out so well.
No, that tends to be a common theme between a lot of people I know. But my brother and I, we bump heads a lot on all kinds of things in life. But when it comes down to he and I teaming up, whether it's going hunting or the business, so far things have gone really well for us. We have really different ways of looking at things, which can sometimes breed a little bit of conflict and discussion, but at the end of the day it brings more ideas to the table, and I think we complement each other really well.
How about growing up? Do you guys get into it much growing up? I know with my brothers, there was more than a handful of times where mom had to put away the fine china, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's plenty of times where we had, the knockout fights between he and I. I'm a year and a half older than him, so I gave him a lot of hard times when he was a little bit younger than me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear that. I'm the oldest of three. I've got a brother. He's about a year and a half, 2 years younger than I am. And same thing. There was I used to give him a lick until he was about 18, and he grew to be about 3 inches taller than me. So that stopped then and there.
There you go.
So you married now?
I'm not. No.
No.
No. Divorced for 4 years now.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah. Gotcha. What about kids?
I've got a 5-year-old son.
Oh yeah, cool. Yeah.
He's a great little boy.
Yeah, I'm sure he's right into the outdoors.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. His favorite food is squirrel tacos. So.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've taken my kids out a few times squirrel hunting, but it's pretty tough. We're only allowed one specific type of squirrel, the gray squirrel.
Okay.
And they seem to only be found in town.
You just can't. Of course.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I don't know if the neighbors would think too highly of us shooting a 22 in the backyard.
No, I think even up in Canada, that might be a problem.
Yeah, that's for sure. So how about your brother? Does he have kids?
He's engaged right now. He has no kids. He's due to get married in October of this year. It got postponed from last year, but yeah, he's on his way to the married life.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So what inspired Smile Outside?
It was because of the books I was reading my son Adam, and my dislike for the constant way that animals are portrayed as cartoons, clothes, talking. They're very anthropomorphized, and it's just not a real good way to introduce kids to wildlife and to have them grow up appreciating like the natural beauty of things. And I think it tends to manifest itself in a way that people have real unrealistic expectations of wildlife management. And I think we're seeing a lot of that rear up here, at least in the States. I'm not sure how it is up for you guys, but there's a lot of anti stuff popping up, a lot of anti legislation. I think a lot of it stems from just this anthropomorphization of wildlife. So our books really focus on portraying animals as they really are, wild animals in their natural beauty. And as I was reading the book to him, I was griping my brother, and he challenged me to write some of my own. And so we right then and there pretty much started planning out the future of the company and what we wanted to write about. We had no idea if it was going to work or take off, but you know, so far it's been a really fun ride. And you know, thanks to my son like loving books and me reading to him some books that I didn't like, that's how it all started.
Yeah. So how long have you guys been doing this now?
So we've been in business now, shipping books for almost a year and a half. And prior to that, there was about a year of planning that went into it before we actually launched our first books.
Oh, there you go. So on the initial launch, how many books were involved?
Our first set of books was a set of 5 books. We called it Conservation Series 1 because we didn't really know what was going to happen. We wanted to make sure that set kind of gave a broad cast of all the different types of wildlife that people might find. So we did one on antlered animals. We did one on pheasants and quail, ducks and geese, one called Clean Water, and then another one that focuses on predators. It's called Coyote Lost Her Voice. We didn't really feel comfortable naming that one Predator for our book. So we tiptoed on the line of anthropomorphization with the coyote in her travels in that book. But we tried to stay as true as we could to our mission.
That's good stuff. You just had an idea of what you wanted to do. So how did you get that idea out to the public? Like there's a lot of processes involved in, you know, getting a book from thought to actual consumer. So like, do you guys have a team you worked with initially, or just did it all yourself? You did all the artwork or?
We definitely did not do the artwork. That is absolutely not one of our strengths. even though we actually, for a very brief moment in time, teetered on the idea of learning how to draw ourselves we put a quick stop to that. So once we had the stories written out, I recruited an art teacher that I worked with at the high school I was teaching at, Anna Ortiz. She illustrated all the five of our first books for us, and additionally one of the books in our next set as well. So yeah, we wrote the books, had them illustrated. We found a printer here in the U.S. that we really liked a lot. We talked to them, and they, of course, ran some samples for us. We loved it, loved the quality they were producing, and then we just have used them since. And they're based out of New York, so it's a little bit of a travel for the shipping, but it's well worth it.
You know, that's something else. Now you said you have two sets of books. You got another one?
Sure, yeah. That's our Conservation Series 2. It's a three-book set, and that focuses on fish. So what we have is one called Fun Fish, and that's a lot of the warm water species like largemouth bass, pike, etc. And one called Cold Water, and that is a fly fishing book about trout species. Actually, trout and char are in there. And then the third one is called Reef, and that's obviously about reef fish and reef ecosystems. And what we did for that set was kind of unique compared to the first set. Actually, we decided to use three different artists, one for each of the books. So each book has a completely different feel to it. One's a digital, one's pastel, and one's watercolor. So they look completely different from each other. And I think it's kind of awesome the way it gives a whole different perspective than the first set. The first set's really beautiful, but it's just kind of cool to have different folks involved in the whole process.
Right. Your books, what kind of content is in each book? Like, what's the message that you want that you guys try to give out through these books? You know, you mentioned you have one that's on different, antlered animals, one on duck and geese, coyotes, etc. What kind of message does each book sort of portray?
So our overall mission for Smile Outside is to educate and engage kids with wildlife and conservation. So we are introducing different species to kids and the different processes of nature, but also in each of their books, we're mixing in like little conservation ethics. Like for example, our pheasants and quail book, we talk about how important the grasses are to those birds, not in just terms of cover, but also to provide food for them and for the insects that they also eat as well. So by pointing out the importance of wild grasses, we're kind of giving a nod to conservation organizations like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, who work really hard to provide good habitat for those species.
It's great. Now, you mentioned a couple conservation groups there. You guys are part of 2% for Conservation as well, aren't you?
Yeah,
that's how I actually found you guys. I just joined that group as well, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, that's a really good organization, and I like that they're promoting a way for companies to show the awesome things that they're doing for conservation.
Yeah, no, Jared has a real vision of what he wants to do and how to get there, and him and his group of people he works with, they do a fantastic job.
Yeah, he's got a little six bell right now. I hope he's doing okay. I'm sure he's going to pull through. He's a tough SOB, I tell you that, though.
So you're in Houston. You moved from Florida. You always been out in Florida?
No, we actually kind of have a weird path that we take. We were born here actually in Houston and moved away when I was five. We moved to California for a decade up in Northern California. We did a lot of hunting and fishing up there. It's a really cool place, actually. People don't really understand the hunting and fishing opportunities that California has, but they have a lot.
Is that right? Yeah, you always hear that there's very limited hunting opportunities in California. I mean, we come from BC, and I think we probably have more species in our province than any other place in North America for the amount of over-the-counter species we can just go hunt. So
California, it's very limited, especially when you talk about big game. It's very limited draw opportunities. I think just even for a deer tag, now this is old information, so I don't know how accurate it is, but you had to apply, and you could apply for one deer tag a year, and not everybody got a deer tag. But They have so many different animals there, from pronghorn to black bears to all kinds of upland game. It's just a really cool place. And in the northern half of the state, they have a lot of national forests and a lot of BLM. So if anyone ever wanted to go to California and hunt public land, it's absolutely something they could do.
We see all the forest fires going on down in California every year, which is, you know, it's amazing that there's anything in California left. It just seems like every year there's a new record set for forest fires in that state. It's amazing that there's any habitat left for wildlife down there.
Yeah, it places on fire quite often.
Yeah, when I think of California, I think it would be more of a traditional non-hunting state. But obviously, if there's hunting opportunity there, then there's going to be hunters. So,
yeah, it's definitely, from what I know from the people who I still keep in contact with out there, it's definitely not a super hunter-friendly state. There's a lot of legislation that's been passed to really restrict a lot of hunting access, but that's a whole different rabbit hole. I don't know if I want to go down right now.
Yeah, I think over the next little bit, you guys with hunting and firearms, you might have your hands full. Just, you know, from what we see up here in Canada with the new government, the change in power, you guys might have a little bit of issues with guns and hunting. I know in Canada here, our federal government, he passed a major bill that was banning a whole whack of firearms, and you know, it's caused a lot of consternation in the community.
I was just
ranting
about that the other day, actually. And am I correct in saying that like semi-auto shotguns were involved in that list?
Some semi-auto shotguns. Now anything over. Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, there was a lot of misconception about it, talk and speculation, and there's so much false information out there that I don't exactly know a definitive list of what's illegal and what's legal. I know any assault style type shotgun, semi-automatic shotguns are illegal, and anything under a 10 gauge is illegal. Now, I could be a little bit wrong about that, but if I am, I'm sure I'm going to hear about it. But as far as I know, that's what it is. For the shotguns. And there was some other firearms on there as well. I know there was a lot of Plinkster 22s that were on the list and stuff that aren't going to do any damage. They're mostly for guys at the range, and yeah. It's basically going to hurt small businesses, what it's going to hurt more than anything.
That's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it is. It really is. So, you know, I want to get back to your business and your book and stuff here, but since we're on the topic of hunting, man, you got a couple hunts I watched that are pretty good. You know what I mean? That's one especially there I want to get into, but maybe your Texas hunt, your Texas mule deer hunt. I was hoping maybe you can just tell me a little bit more about that. I watched a bit of the video that you and your brother made.
Yeah. Disclaimer, I'm not a good film editor at all, or we're not good filmers either. So it's just for fun, but that it was a really, really cool hunt. And the way it works down here in Texas is it was a mule deer hunt, and in Texas, big game other than white-tailed deer for the most part is on a special draw. And the mule deer there's not a lot of mule deer tags issued in the state for public land. Now, if you have private land, there's tags that you can buy with your over the counter with your license, not a problem on private land. But as far as public land goes, there's not a lot of opportunities. And the property that I got drawn for was the Big Bend Ranch State Park. It's way down south on the southern border of Texas, right against Mexico, actually. And in that unit, it's a 300,000 acre unit. It used to be a private ranch that Texas Parks and Wildlife took over. They purchased it a number of years ago and use it for recreation purposes now. But they issue a dozen rifle permits a year for that unit. And as you can imagine, the demand for those permits is really high. So I've been applying for that hunt for 11 years at the time before I drew. And I was actually very lucky to draw. I felt really lucky, but it's a random draw. So I saw people there that had been applying for 1 year. So it's good to have that random possibility, but it's highly unlikely to draw ever again. And that's too bad, because I would really love to go there. It's a
yeah.
Is there, if you already get drawn, can you still put in for another draw?
Yeah, you can.
But you just have, like, in BC, how it works here is we run off a lottery system. And then if you, supposedly, if you've had a draw on the lot for some species, the next 3 years are harder to get. You have less chances of getting if you had never drawn. Is it the same down there?
No, we don't have that for here. I know a lot of the Western states down here have waiting periods for some of their, like, moose, sheep, and goat tags, and some are just once in a lifetime even. But down here, no, we can apply again. So I'm back in it now. I got a couple, like, 2 points now again, but I drew it, and it's a beautiful desert ecosystem down there. It's very mountainous as far as mountains go in Texas.
Yeah, it looked like the landscape that you guys are filming there. I mean, the landscape looked cool. It was surprising that it was in Texas, because when I think of Texas, you know, being from Canada, and we, you know, the mountainous regions that we have, you think of Texas as just being flat and full of cactus and right. sand. There was nice rolling hills and some trees and sagebrush, and yeah, it looked pretty neat down there, man.
Yeah, it honestly was one of the most beautiful places I've been to, and I've been all over the country. I really enjoyed it. So the way it worked was there's different compartments in the unit, and we have an orientation prior to the hunt where the the warden, he does a random draw and assigns each of the hunters one of the compartments. And the compartment I got drawn in was my absolute last choice if I could have chosen. It was a compartment that was right where the visitor center is, and it was super flat, had really probably the poorest habitat in the entire park. I hunted it for one day, saw maybe one set of tracks. I put on like 7 or 8 miles on my boots. Luckily, there was a couple hunters that did not show up for the hunt, so I was able to go back and talk to the warden, and he let me swap out my unit, my compartment. So I was able to, the next day, hunt a unit that had a lot of really good terrain in it, a lot of places for bucks to hide. And it was only a 2.5 day hunt, so it wasn't a lot of time. And the next morning, it rained. It rained a lot prior to us getting out there, and it was wet and cold, and this is all Texas standard, so a lot of your listeners might be laughing at me now.
I'm sure they are the Canadian. Well, I mean, the majority of my listeners are Canadian, so
as the rain kind of rolled out, sun got a little higher, me and my brother we hiked over a couple of ridges about a mile and a half or so from where we parked, and found this really beautiful drainage that had a lot of fingers feeding into it, and it just felt right. So we decided to sit there and, you know, hang out for at least the rest of the morning hunt. And it wasn't long before a group of does come barreling over the hill in front of us about 200 yards away, and in hot pursuit. As the video shows, is a pretty mature buck chasing one of the does really hard. He was very intent on.
He was definitely hot after that one doe. it's definitely worth checking the video. Yeah, he was right on her heels the whole way for a little bit too.
Yeah, and it was cool. I don't know if you heard. If you turn the volume up, you can hear him grunting in there, and. It was just really cool. And finally, he got to a position that was pretty steep, quartering away shot for me. And I went ahead and let one rip and ended up getting my first mule deer buck. And it was really cool, a really cool experience. Just the way it all unfolded made it even that much better. And in the place that I was in and had my brother there, it was just one of like those hunts that's just kind of like perfect, you know, like
yeah.
Everything lined up.
Yeah, no, it was, that was a nice muley, man. That was your first muley. It was a good looking buck. Did they end up aging the buck for you at the end?
No, they didn't. They didn't age the buck.
I figured it to be about a 3 or 4 year old myself, just looking at it. But if that was a BC buck, I would say, yeah, that's definitely a 3 year.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. He had a little bit of a nose starting to roll up on top and some gray in the face a little bit. So I knew he was probably past 2.5 for sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, compared to the whitetails I shoot out here, like, he was huge. Like, his body was just huge. And
yeah,
he's probably small compared to y'all's deer. But I mean, the crazy thing about that hunt was for the biologist there, they didn't age it, which was weird. They didn't pull any teeth or anything like that. They just wanted the weight, the dressed out weight. So we were allowed to dress out the animal in the field, but they wanted us to bring it whole back to.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so weird.
So we had to drag this buck out 1.5 miles. And I mean, there's a ton of cactus out there. I was taking pictures. I think I documented like 17 different cactus species out there with my camera. It was slow going to get around all that stuff, but at the end of the day, we got him out.
What did he weigh in at?
He dressed out, he was 160.
Oh yeah, that's a decent buck, man.
Yeah,
right on. Yeah, no, that's good. That was a good hunt, fun to watch for sure.
Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it, man.
You guys you chased my antelope down there as well.
Yeah, so we've hunted antelope in New Mexico, I think twice. The first time, my brother and I both, we drew a party application, so we both got tags. He ended up shooting a really nice buck, and I ended up not. And then it was a muzzleloader hunt. I ended up throwing that muzzleloader in the garbage. I sold it, but It was a muzzleloader I've had for like 20 years, and I think in the early stages of my muzzleloader hunting, I didn't really know how to care for the barrel that good and clean that barrel out. So it was just a cruddy barrel. Needless to say, I didn't shoot anything. I missed some buck, but I came back a couple of years later and I shot a nice one myself. And
So you got redemption.
I did. I really did.
Yeah, those are pretty neat critters. I got an antelope this September, archery antelope, which is pretty cool.
You don't have those in BC?
No, we don't. I got a buddy out in Alberta, so there's a lot of antelope out there. So I went out and hunted with him, and their technique's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty gnarly way of hunting. I don't know. It's definitely leave it up to an Alberta to come up with this style of hunting. So basically, we drive in glass fields. When we spot a group of antelope, he would call, ask for permission from the landowner. Once we have permission, we conjure up a strategy plan of how to get within 100 yards of those antelope, 200 yards, 100 yards. So we'd sneak out, me following him. He has a decoy, a buck decoy, like an antelope buck decoy. It's down. I'm behind him with an arrow knocked, and we're belly crawling along the sage grass and the cactus. And we try to sneak up to the group till we can get within about, 100, 200 yards. So we'd sit there, and then once we got to a good spot, he'd flip the decoy up. And then right away, the dominant buck in the group, he'd see the decoy, and he'd start getting all riled up and doing circles and stuff and take charges at this decoy. And then the idea was the antelope's going to run up, and at the last second, he's going to realize that it's not an antelope, and he's going to stop. The guy in front's quickly going to get a range on it. In that time, you have to draw back. When he ranges it, he's going to say left or right, indicating which side of the decoy the antelope is on. So he ranges it for you, says left or right, you draw back. As he yells out the range and the position, he dives out of the opposite way, and you're supposed to let the arrow fly. We did it a few times. We never got close enough where I could actually let an arrow fly, but we end up getting one, and I got him at 52 yards, and he was kind of running away, and I let an arrow go, and it got him. It was a little bit back, but nonetheless, I got my first antelope. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds pretty exciting, though.
Yeah, yeah, but man, those things sure taste good.
Oh yeah, man.
Underrated. Yeah, they are. I didn't. The meat didn't last long. I got back in the first week of September, and it was gone by the end of the month. We ate it every night at barbecues, and
nice.
My brothers dipped into it and they snagged a whole bunch. But another hunt I want to talk to you about, kind of the main event, what I've been, biting my fingernails to talk to you about. I've spent a lot of time chasing elk up here in BC. I had a lot of tough, unsuccessful hunts. Let me back up here. So, like many hunters, there's probably, I got a bucket list of hunts I want to do, like I'm sure you do and a lot of guys listening do. But for me, my top three are New England stag, a grizzly bear hunt. And, now that the grizzly bear is banned from hunting in BC, it's going to have to be a Yukon grizzly, and a New Mexico elk hunt. So for an American citizen, outside of hiring a guide, how does one get a New Mexico elk hunt? Without getting into any specifics of your hunt, how does one just acquire such a hunt?
So
is that an over the counter, or again, does that work on an entry hunt?
So New Mexico is one of just a small handful of Western states that has a random draw, no preference points, no bonus point system for their big game. So it's a completely random draw for residents and non-residents. However, they only allow up to 6% of available tags for any particular unit to be issued to a non-resident without a guide. So if you're a non-resident applying in New Mexico for elk or for any other big game for that matter, you can apply and you are hoping to get one of the up to 6% of the tags available in that unit. If you go through a guide in New Mexico, there's another set of tags up to 10% that are allocated for, I think it's guides, not just specifically non-residents, but it's guided hunts. So you have to have some paperwork saying that you already have hired a guide before you can apply into that draw. But for you, if you're not hiring a guide, you can apply. It's a completely random draw. You pick your top couple, two, three, forget how many units, and you just hold your breath for a long time.
Is there a lot of entries? Like, do a lot of mugs put in for that draw?
Yeah, so, it depends on which units. Some units are a little bit better odds, but generally it's not a very likely tag that you're going to get drawn. I was super lucky in the fact that I got drawn number one for a unit.
And don't tell me any details about your hunt or what you got yet, because I kind of want to tee it up here.
I'm not saying anything yet. But the crazy part is I got drawn for that hunt and for my New Mexico antelope hunt in the same year, the one that I got my antelope on.
Oh, really?
So I had back to back hunts, like, just two or three months apart on, and it's like super low odds. And I drew both tags, and I was really ecstatic about that.
So you did the antelope hunt before the elk hunt?
The antelope hunt was in August.
Oh yeah. So that's a good, at least that way you get an idea of the terrain and stuff in the landscape.
Yeah. So I was able to go do my antelope hunt, and I got that done pretty quickly. I think it was the first day of the hunt, actually, either the first or second day of the hunt. And then I had a few remaining days I had scheduled in for that hunt. So I drove a couple hours and went and did some scouting for my elk hunt that year. So I got some boots on the ground, which was really awesome.
Yeah. No, it definitely paid off in the end. So, like I said, I spent a lot of time watching elk, talking elk, studying elk, hunting elk. In all that time, I've never heard the phrase, I killed my first elk on my very first trip, or on the very first day of my very first trip. How about you?
I don't know where you would have heard that before.
Man, I've just been dying to hear the details about this hunt.
Well, there's definitely a lot of luck that plays into that. I mean, for sure. I have this conversation with Luke all the time, and I don't know why it keeps coming up, but there's definitely a lot of luck, but I feel like we prepared for it. We spent a lot of time. Well, first of all, okay, so I applied for the unit. It was my last last choice of units that I chose, and I chose it because it was one of the higher odds, which I think was still like a 2 or 3% chance of drawing. And it's not known for having like really big bulls in it, which I didn't care about. The success rate was lower than most units, which I really didn't care about either. When he and I go hunting, we tend to look at like hunter success rates and kind of double those odds for he and I, just because we're probably more seasoned than most hunters that are calculated into that. So when we did that, we had about a 40% chance of getting a bull out of there. And so I drew. It was awesome. We went to the antelope hunt, finished that up early, drove out, and we had done tons and tons. I mean, I don't know how many dozens of hours I spent on the computer, on chat rooms, talking to folks, on Google Earth, looking at satellite images. I mean, just combing over every square inch, trying to find out. And honestly, like one of the most important things that I did as a new elk hunter was I went back to Randy Newberg's podcasts and YouTubes and re-listened to everything that he talked about when it came to hunting late season elk. Are y'all familiar with Newberg up there?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, you betcha.
So I think that was actually really integral. I'm not trying to like be like a Randy fan. I love him. He's a great guy. But it helped me a lot, kind of just understand what I was trying to look for on those maps. One of the biggest things that I came across in my scouting was a guy on the Hunt Talk forum who said that he's hunted that unit before. And he pointed me in a direction of a particular area, and I asked him why. And he said, oh, because it's easier to access. You don't want to go over here because it's impossible to access. It's all just cliffs, and you can't get an elk out of there, even if you did shoot one. I was like, perfect. That's where I'm going. So
I was gonna say, because I seen the video, and if where you guys were wasn't the place he was talking about, then man, I wouldn't even want to see the place he was talking about, because you guys were you're in some pretty gnarly terrain there with those cliffs, and man, yeah. But anyway, I keep going here. I'm interrupting. Yes.
So we started focusing our scouting attention on that general area of the unit, which was really, really, there's a lot of steep cliffs there. It kind of just falls off the end of the earth on that side of the unit. So we were looking for places that would have just a little bit of food and some sanctuary. And we narrowed it down to a couple different spots that we were able to go do some hiking on back in August of that year. And we found two areas that we liked a lot, like really looked good. We saw a lot of old sign, which doesn't mean anything. And we didn't see any elk at all, which also didn't mean anything to us, because we knew this unit was a really big migratory corridor type of unit. So we knew we were going to be hunting in December, was when this tag was. So we didn't care if we didn't see elk there in August. It wasn't any of our concern. Again, we were just hoping that was a good way to think about it. And, so December came around, we drove out there. We were hoping that no one would be already in that area camped up when we got there. And it was kind of a pain to drive down and get down this dirt road. We got there and no one was there yet. We got there the day before the season opened. So we were able to set up camp. And just before it got dark, we got set up and for camp and got some sleep. We woke up bright and early the next morning. We had about a 15-minute walk to the edge of a cliff where we could look down this cliff into a valley and had some really good visibility. And I'm like embarrassed to say, like 15 minutes into glassing, I see a bull. And I'm like, hey, Luke, there's an elk. And so then we're watching this bull trying to find out where it's going to go bed down for the day. And in that, I don't know, it was probably about a 2-hour period, we end up seeing three more bulls pop up with him that we didn't see right away. So it ended up there with four bulls hanging out together in a little bachelor group.
You guys must have been just like, man, I like I thought elk hunting was supposed to be tough here. What's, you know what I mean? Like, that's crazy.
It is crazy. And I think it kind of made up for it in the location that it was in, because we could see them just fine from where we were. They were only 1200 and some odd yards away from us, but in order for us not to have to literally rappel down a cliff 800 feet, we had to backtrack. I don't know. Instead of walking a straight mile, we had to end up walking. It was probably close to like 4 or 5 miles to get to where those bulls were. By the time we got there, it was late in the evening. It was probably, I don't remember what time it was. Maybe like an hour before dark or before shooting light. I forget what it was exactly, but it was late in the day. It took us 5 or 6 hours to get over there. And didn't see anything. We were hoping they would feed back out into that little grass pasture that we were watching them feed in, and they didn't. So right before it started getting too dark for us, we knew we had a really crappy hike back to camp. We were going to take a shortcut this time, which was a more direct route since we weren't trying to hide from elk. So we decided to leave our vantage point there a little bit early while we still had enough light to kind of get started. And maybe 200 or 300 yards away, we saw a group of doe, mule deer. And we're just looking at them, like kind of saying how cool it was. You know, it was a bunch of does hanging out here. It's awesome. And then I glance to my left, and 100 yards away, there's a bull. Just looking right at us. And it was crazy at that moment. Like, we didn't get any footage of this because it happened just so fast. And I threw my bag off my back. I got my rifle down, and it just happened. He turned. So it was perfect. Again, it was so crazy. He turned perfectly broadside after he was already facing me. He saw us, turned broadside, and just stopped for enough time where I was able to take a nice shot with my 308. I thought it was a really perfect shot. It turned out it was right where I was aiming, but I'm used to putting my crosshairs on the shoulder of a whitetail and it dropping, but I pulled that trigger and this guy ran like he didn't even have any clue that there was a bullet in him.
Yeah. They're tough critters, man. What caliber were you using?
I'm shooting a 308. I use 150 grain partitions. I know it's a little bit light for some people, but I feel really comfortable with that rifle. And quite frankly, I don't like my shoulder getting kicked too much with anything more. So I shoot well with it,
shoot. I shoot a 308 as well. I shoot a 168 grain, but I've shot, you know, I killed a lot of critters with a 308, so that's a good rifle. It's definitely good enough for any elk, but so you shot him. He took off.
Shot him. He turns and runs, and Luke's going, shoot him again. And I took two more shots as he was running. I end up hitting him with one of the shots, and he fell down within 50 yards. And I mean, I was just in complete awe.
Yeah.
just shocked. We walked up to him. I'm sure anybody who's ever shot their first elk, it's huge.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Such a big animal.
It's just your feeling of accomplishment, I think. You know what I mean? Just to get your first elk down, have it on the ground. And then, I mean, for you guys, you know, like with my first elk, there was a lot of suffering and anguish before the animal was down. With you guys, I think you experienced that after the elk was down.
For sure.
So, I mean, but it's something else.
Yeah. So it came almost too easy. And usually I like don't enjoy those kind of hunts where it just happens so fast and you don't feel like you earned it. But like you're saying, like after the pack out, the following couple of days, we took our time. We did one trip a day. So we packed out, I think, back straps and tenderloins that night and the trim, and then left the four quarters for the next 2 days. So we packed out that stuff. We took a shortcut, and we almost died. because the shortcut ended up putting us a little bit too close to the cliff. We were hoping to skip the cliff by this shortcut, but we ended up getting cliffed out a couple of times in the middle of the night. It was like 2 o'clock when we got back. We were crossing like scree fields that were almost vertical. At one point, I literally had to jump and grab a tree, like sprawled out, because I thought I was going to fall off a cliff. It was actually really stupid. And probably like, we put ourselves probably in a situation that we shouldn't have been in.
Yeah. And it's funny that, you know what I mean? Because you always talk about, I'm not retarded. I'll never put myself in that situation. But when you're out there, I mean, I've put myself in that situation more than once. And, you know, I've been stuck hung up on a cliff and I couldn't get up or down. I had to literally pull my pack off, lower my pack to the bottom with a rope attached to it, then tie a stick or a twig or something around it, throw it up behind me just so I could get up top. And then I'd have to pull my bag up after, like, and then you tell yourself, oh, I'm never going to get in that situation again. And then, you know, lo and behold, you find yourself in another situation similar to that. And you're like, man, what am I doing? When am I going to learn my lesson? It's easier than you think. That's for sure. You look at it, you're like, yeah.
And I don't think people do it intentionally going into it.
No, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah.
So fast, before you know it, you're in a situation and where you can't reverse yourself and it's not good. But we got out of there that night. We were tired. We slept in the next morning a little bit until maybe like 7 or 8, got up, had a nice breakfast and went down and pulled the hindquarters out. And that was an experience completely new to us is an elk hindquarter in your back.
Yeah. The weight. You might as well be carrying another human in there.
We put it on a scale when we got back home, and those quarters were 65 pounds each. So that's just not counting all the water and food and everything else we brought. I mean, we're probably, I don't know, probably like a 75, 80 pound pack at that point. But
yeah, man, I hear you. I know all about it. It's not easy.
No, the thing that I'm most thankful for on that hunt was the weather. It was like clear blue skies, but it was like in the teens. So it was super cold. We had absolutely no worry of meat spoilage. And we didn't have snow or ice or water that we were worried about slipping on. I can just imagine that pack out, if there was ice on those rocks, it would have been really bad. But yeah, we packed out two days. We got the rest of that elk out. We enjoyed some really good meat over fire. We had a really good time, and it's just, I'm so glad that we brought the camera to document some of that hunt. And, you know,
yeah, it was cool, man. It was cool watching you guys. Well, I mean, just the way the hunt went down, you know, like I said, it's your very first elk on your very first day of your very first trip. And then, you know, you're looking at it being like, wow, man, this is easy. And all that. And then you get an animal down and then the true suffering and pain. And I mean, you guys went through all the same experiences, you know, maybe a different order than some hunts that, you know, that I've been on myself or some other hunts, but I mean, it's all the same. But, so was that the first time you ever ate elk? Was your elk?
Yeah, that was, I mean, other than I've had like elk jerky from the store. That doesn't
make it though. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, that was the first time we've actually had elk, and man, that is some really high quality meat. That is so good.
You know, along with moose, it's top notch. Antelope's up there too.
All right, so don't get me started on moose, because I have an obsession with moose. That is my absolute number one bucket list animal.
Yeah, whereabouts? What state?
I don't care.
Wherever? What states can you hunt moose in? I know, well, obviously Alaska, Washington, I imagine.
I know. So I don't apply to any Western states for moose because the odds are so low and the tags are really expensive. But in the Northeast, there's Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont have moose tags as well. They have better odds, and especially Maine has, I think they have like around 3,000 moose tags a year that they give out. So the odds are in Maine are really a lot higher, and the tags are about half as much as if I drew in the West. But the crazy thing is, I have a buddy in Alaska who is a hunting fool. His name is Ryan Carter. You guys can go look him up and harass him. But this guy, he, I think like a lot of Alaskans, shoots a moose every year, and he's always given me an open invitation to come up there. But the seasons conflict with my day job of teaching. so bad that I can't take the time off to go up there. And but if I was to pick one place to go, it would probably be BC.
Yeah.
However, I cannot afford a guide.
So yeah.
Chances of me hunting in BC are zero.
Yeah. How it is up here with non-residents and stuff like that. It's really tough for them to come up and do a hunt. It's expensive, but we definitely have some monster moose up here. We've got some monster moose, some big elk, big muleys, a little bit of everything. And it's all over the counter too. You can go hunt mountain sheep, mountain goat, elk, moose, caribou, whitetail, mule deer, bear, cougar. You just got to go down and pay, anywhere from 20 to 40 bucks for it. So
that's what it's costing you as your residents over there. 20, yeah. 40 bucks.
Oh, yeah, man. I just picked up a lynx and a bobcat tag, and it was, I think, $16 for the both of them.
That's awesome. That's
so
awesome.
Did you mount your elk?
I did a European mount. So I did it myself. It came out really nice. I left it in on my back patio for a couple of days to air out and dry after I did it. And I was really, really pissed off because the squirrels got to the antlers. And they so it has about 5 or 6 places on it that the squirrels were gnawing on my antlers.
On it? Yeah.
So I don't know. I've been debating whether to patch it up and make it look better or just leave it as is as a reminder of what not to do. So I don't know, but it looked really good. It came out pretty nice.
Yeah. A couple scars never hurt. Builds character. That's what my wife says anyway. But man, I know you're busy, and I'm looking at the clock here, and we've already chewed up an hour, and it feels like it's been about 15 minutes. So,
wow.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap this up here, but do you have any hunting plans for 2021?
I'm going to do another spring bear hunt in Montana, early June. That's my first plan for 2021. And then other than that, I don't know what we're going to be doing. We'll see once draw applications start going in.
What about Smile Outside? Is there anything you want to add to the listeners, or you got any plans for some new books coming out?
If you guys have kids or know kids that are in families that enjoy the outdoors or just enjoy animals in general, they're a really great set of books. They introduce a lot of different species of wildlife, and of course, we give back to conservation, so you can feel good about yourself and love your kids all in one fell swoop.
What is it? 50 cents of every book goes towards conservation, I think,
at least,
I read?
Yeah, at least 50 cents from every book that we sell goes back to conservation, so that's right around, depending on if we catch it on sale or not, at least 7% of our sales were given to conservation.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's a great thing that you guys are doing. So my hat's off to you and your brother. That's great work. And the books you have are great. I haven't got my books yet, but I got some on the way. So I'm looking forward to that, reading them to my kids. Absolutely. But where can all us Canadians find you?
So the best place to find us is either on smileoutside.com. That's our website. Or if you want to go to our Instagram, we post a lot of pictures on there of our books and kids enjoying the books from folks that are sending us pictures. That's _smile_outside. And you can contact us through either of those avenues and ask us any questions that you want. We're happy to answer anything you need questions on.
Yeah, right on. No, I got, I'm going to put all your information up on the show notes, and I'm going to have a link to your guys' website on my webpage too. So, people can look forward to that, but, man, this is, it's been a good time here. We should do it again sometime.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate the invite and definitely a good chat. I love talking hunting to anybody.
Oh man. Yeah, for sure. Okay, buddy. I'm going to let you go. I know you got some students that are probably eager to learn something, so I'll let you get back after it.
All right, man. Good chat. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Do you believe that? Wow, I guess it's all worth it.
I'm Will Cooper, and you're listening to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast on the Waypoint Podcast Network. Stick around as I bring you more stories and interviews from veteran hunters and industry professionals who inspire us all to be better equipped in the woods and in life. You're listening to the Waypoint Podcast Network, brought to you in part by HuntStand, the number one hunting and land management app.